Wolf, if you haven't caught on yet, the gray wolf sitting on a chair last night, according to one person. Qualifications for being a Bible study here are that you occasionally know something about the Bible. And I taught Hebrew, Old Testament, and archaeology, a few other things in several seminaries. And I've always loved it and still do. I retired. Some of you maybe heard that before, but you're supposed to repeat it again. I retired in January, and I'm doing a lot of things, mostly in aging and in retirement training and gerontology. And I work in a nursing home part-time now as the educational gerontology for the residents and their adult children. And we have a lot of fun doing that. Some people had to have me explain what I meant by a lot of fun dealing with death and dying, but, you know, each to his own, as they say. We've been running occasionally some things on the Psalms, and just a quick introduction today. The more familiar type of Psalms we all know, like the Psalms of Trust, the one we said at Matins this morning, a Psalm of Trust or a Hymn of Praise like Psalm 103 that we took yesterday. Those are a big category. They usually call them hymns. That's a simple word for them. And the word for psalm really means that. It's a praise hymn. That's what the word psalm means in Latin. And tehillah, which is the Hebrew word for psalm, means the same thing. Then the next biggest category of types of psalms are laments, or prayers for forgiveness, or prayers for rescue, that kind of thing. And Psalm 51 that we did last week, and Psalm 22 that we're going to do tomorrow, those are laments. They're rather obvious. Then there's some hymns of enthronement or coronation or whatever you want, like Psalm 110. And many of the ones, the Lord has gone up with a shout. Well, something's happened when you say that. Either God's gone up or the king's gone up or they've both gone up, and you're reestablishing a covenant. Now, one of the minor groups, but I think it's an important group to think about, is the psalm we're dealing with today. Psalm 51 gets lost because there aren't many psalms like it. It's a particular kind of psalm in a particular form. We also find it in the prophets, and we find it in some of the historical writings in a form. Let me give you a little introduction before we start to that, and maybe we'll finish the psalm, maybe we won't, any more than we finished Psalm 103 yesterday. But we now know that when you talk about a covenant, and we talk about the Old Covenant and the New Covenant, or the Old Testament and the New Testament, you know, we use those phrases. We talk about the Mosaic Covenant, we talk about the Abraham Covenant, and some people talk about the Noah Covenant. And when we talk about covenants, we're really talking about an agreement that people made. Now, there are two kinds of agreements that we know from ancient literature. One is an agreement between equals. Supposedly, modern marriage is between equals. Earlier, 200 years ago, or maybe even 100 years ago, marriage wasn't between equals. Marriage was different. You know, there was one that was more considered as a kind of a property thing. Back in the time of Jesus or other times, there wasn't that much either. But we also have what are known as suzerain or vassalage treaties. And the Hittites have them, the Babylonians have them. And we think we see some references to the literary form, at least, in the Old Testament. I'll refer to a few of those as we get going here. Thanks for maybe that'll give us another kind of draft. I think it'll bring the draft out a little bit more. Thank you, Karen. If you get overcome with smoke, the exits are that way. I think we'll be all right. It looks like it's going fine. It smells good. All right, we'll let it smell good. It's I think it's mostly going up. Now, a suzerain or a vassal treaty is I'm the king who's conquered the country, and you're the petty kings who are down here below. So Judah would be a vassal of Assyria, right, when they conquered it? Or if Judah or Israel happened to be strong and they conquered Edom or Moab, then Edom and Moab would be the vassal, and Israel would be the strong king or the strong country. When it's that kind of a covenant, you have certain forms you follow, whether it's Assyrian or Hittite or Old Testament. We're going to look at that because that's what Psalm 50 is. Psalm 50 is a very interesting psalm because it's the trial of the covenant breakers. It's really a trial. It's a drama. We'll look at some historic items on this first before we look at the psalm specifically. But it really is a trial. Now, I've been telling you about various words in the King James. I'm going to do you a little bit of another favor. You know, transgression usually means rebellion, the real alienation of sin. Iniquity means you didn't quite make it and didn't live up to the morals. Evil means you're a twisted, perverted kind of a person. Those words, when you see them in the King James, they refer to specific Hebrew words. Now, in the King James, you sometimes hear the phrase, the Lord has a controversy, or there's a controversy of the Lord. The word controversy really should be translated charge or trial. Not charge like the San Diego Chargers, but charge that the district attorney gets against people when they've done something wrong. So whenever you see the word in the King James, which says quarrel, or the Lord has a controversy against Israel, it means he's got a charge. They're on the defense now. And they might have all kinds of alibis, they may have some defense attorneys, but the Lord has his own prosecuting attorney, who may be the prophet at times, who may be the unknown psalmist, or it may be some of the angels. We're not sure. We talked about angels briefly yesterday. Now, before we deal with this psalm, let's just look at one of the very easy ones, and I think it's one of the ones that I like to deal with because so many people take the last verse of this trial scene out of context. Micah 6:8 is often quoted by social gospel people, by civil rights people, by human rights people, and they act like it's the final gospel or the final law, whichever you want to do. But if you turn to chapter 6 of the prophet Micah, you'll have no difficulty seeing what I'm going to try to tell you. Micah 6, verse 8. And you'll note, if you watch it very carefully, if you don't have Bibles, they're back there. Fine, thank you. There may be any others need some. I'm just going to show some parts of it. And I put some of it up here. If you're trying to get an outline of it, we'll do it with the other. Micah, the 6th chapter, verses 1 through 8. Okay, first of all, you have the call, the bailiff, if you want to put it. The bailiff calls the people, the witnesses, as well as the others, to trial, to come to the court. Sometimes they describe the setting, sometimes they don't. In the Hittite treaty and in the Assyrian treaties, they call maybe 100 or 130 different gods and goddesses to all come and help us in this big trial between the Hittite king and the little guy who didn't obey. And they're all called. Now, in the Hebrew Bible and in the psalm we're going to look at and right now, all of those gods have been demythologized. Is that a phrase you've heard about? They take the capital letters out and put little letters in. And so instead of the god of the mountain, it says, arise, plead your cause before the mountains. Let the hills hear your voice. Hear, you mountains, the controversy of the Lord. Now, if you want to, change that to charge or the accusation, and you know exactly what you do. And you, enduring foundations of the earth, you be witnesses. For the Lord has a controversy with his people. He will contend with Israel. Are you with me? Micah 6, verses 1 to 3. Now, you note there's a paragraph if you have the RSV. We've set the scene. We've called the witnesses. Now we've got the specific charge. It comes and it's in quotations. And the specific charge has several things. Verses 3 through 5. It has the charge, and in this particular thing, it also has some historical evidence of why I have the right to do this, or why you've had a historical predisposition to go ahead and break the treaty. So you've got the invitation or the setting or the calling to the witnesses, whatever you want. The charge is now being done, and part of this, we have it in Micah, it says the historical context. Let me just read quickly. Oh, my people, what have I done to you? How have I wearied you? In other words, you people aren't responding the way you ought to. And then here's Why do I have a right to say these, to contend against you, give you charge? Didn't I bring you up out of the land of Egypt? Didn't I redeem you from the house of bondage? Didn't I send you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam? Didn't I do some things about Balaam and Balak and remember all the acts in the book of Judges at Gilgal? And you've known the saving acts of the Lord. I've delivered you before. How come you aren't loyal to your deliverer? That's really the charge, isn't it? You're disloyal. You're either going after other gods, or you're going after another nation or another king, or you're not keeping the stipulations of the covenant, the laws that we asked you to give, the Ten Commandments, which we'll talk about when we get to Psalm 50. Now comes, this doesn't have the stipulations yet. They're just implied in this one. Instead, you have the defense. The defense attorney now gets up, where all the people come with their alibis. God, you ask so blooming much of you. How can I know what you really want? That's really what this says in verse 6, 7, and 8, and so on. Verse 6 and 7, I'm sorry, because 8 is the important one we want to get to at the end. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Can't you see them raising their hands in holy horror? God, what the hell do you expect of me? You know, what do you want out of me? Shall I come before you with burnt offerings and a calf a little? And then look at the sarcasm, maybe, of the defense. You know, what do you expect? 1,000 rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? And then really irony in the defense. Shall I give my firstborn like the Egyptians had to do? You follow the gutsy defense they're making? They're really fighting God. Shall I give my firstborn, the fruit of my body, for the sin of my being? And then the quotation mark stop. That's the alibi. That's the defense. Now you could, in other passages, you'll find, they'll say, well, I did this, I did this, I did this. How come you're getting mad at me for not doing this? You'll have passages like that in the history books as well as in some of the prophets. Now, verse 8 is the verse that most people know. Most people forget the first 7 verses and they read verse 8 and say, here's the civil rights thing. Here's ERA. Here's human rights. Here are all these things. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Okay. 3 things are said there, all of which have to do with what God really requires. And what we're getting now is a suspended judgment. We're not getting a judgment that says, I'm going to get rid of you, you're no longer my people, which is what you hear in Isaiah. Remember, Isaiah has a child named, not my people. You know, you're a bastard now. You're not mine. I'm not even going to pick you up and say you belong to me. You're gone. But here, you don't have the judgment that you get in Malachi or in Joshua or in Isaiah. You get a suspended sentence saying, if you remember the stipulations, this is all I require of you. What has he showed you? What does the Lord require? Okay, to do justice means to live up to the stipulations of the covenant. To do what are the stipulations. To love kindness, note your footnote if you have an RSV. I don't know why they stayed kindness, except that's what everybody thought sounded so nice. But it's steadfast love. If God loves me with steadfast loyalty, I need to respond with steadfast loyalty. So not only do I obey the laws, I respond with love. If you want to use another translation, you could use covenant love. And then the last is gorgeous. Remember who you are. You're just a bunch of human beings who are my vassals. I'm the king. Walk humbly before the Lord. Has very little to say about servanthood in the New Testament that we do on our altar over here with the foot washing scene and the statue. This is what the Lord is saying. Okay, I'll give you another chance. If you try to keep the stipulations, if you respond to my loyal love with your steadfast love, and if you remember who's boss in this arrangement, that this isn't a mutual covenant, this is a covenant between a sovereign Lord and some dependent people. Now that puts that passage in a different light, doesn't it, than just that it's a general overall idea about how people should live in the 20th century. It's putting it in relationship to the whole covenant. And if I wanted to put it in the New Testament, I'd say, what does the Lord require of me? in the New Testament. It would be to live with the fruits of my faith, which is a response to my salvation. Because who am I but one who has been redeemed by the blood of the Lamb? And that would be another way of putting it for the New Testament context. One other passage, just from a historical book that you might want to look at just for fun. We won't spend as much time. Joshua 24, I think it is. This is a historical book, you know. And this one actually seems to be a real trial, not just a poetic idea about it. Joshua chapter 24. I'm not going to go through it. I'll ask you to read some of it later. But Joshua gathers the tribes. Joshua says, "Thus says the Lord," and then he tells you all about how he called the Israelites. "Your fathers did this. I led them here. I gave them this. I brought them out of Egypt." You see all the historical things. What right has God got to tell you who you are and what you've got to do? He's got it because he's the one who saved you. He's the one who delivered you. He's the one who even made you a people. And all that, you go all the way down to there. And then it talks about some of the fact that you've been in a habit of not always being obedient and following through. And then verse 14, they give some stipulations. "Fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and in faithfulness. Put away the gods which your fathers served. Serve the Lord." And then comes that passage, which is again often quoted in Protestant and Catholic circles. "Choose you this day whom you will serve." And then later on, that comes up again. "You cannot serve the Lord, for he is a holy God." So he's asking them to renew the covenant. Are we going to accept his law and his sovereignty, or aren't we? And then Joshua says at verse 22, "You are witnesses against yourselves that you have chosen the Lord to serve him." And they all said, "We're witnesses. Swear to God, that's what we really mean to do. We're going to do it forever. We're going to be steadfast and loyal and trustful. And we're going to be obedient." And they weren't saying the Boy Scout oath. They were just speaking about what they're talking about. And so verse 26, 24, 25, and 26. "The Lord our God we will serve, his voice we will obey." So Joshua made a covenant with the people that day and made statutes and ordinances for them at Shechem. And then one thing we don't find in the Psalms at all, although it's hinted at occasionally, we do find it in the Hittite and the Assyrian treaties. Once all the heavens and all the gods have been there, once the vassals have agreed, once the witnesses have signed it, you then deposit it in the temple. You deposit it in the temple, just like my will is in my safety deposit box, with witnesses of the contract I've made with the lawyer and what I want done with my property. I also have my property deeds in my safety deposit box because it's a contract and it's a good place to keep it. Well, they didn't have safety deposit boxes. They used the temple. And so what happens? "And Joshua wrote these words in the book of the laws of God, and he took a great stone and set it up there under the oak of the sanctuary of the Lord. And Joshua said to all the people," two things, "Behold, this stone shall be a witness against us, for it has heard all the words of the Lord which he spoke to you. Therefore it shall be a witness against you, lest you deal falsely with your God." The stone has two purposes. One, it's a perpetual reminder that they did make this. And one, it's a perpetual reminder that there is a copy here, and we get you. We'll pull it out when you have the contests after my death, that you're not going to have a squabble about it. Now, there's a possibility that he again is demythologized. If this were a Hittite treaty, and the Hittite treaties were about 300 to 400 years before Joshua, the stone might not be a real stone. It'd be the stone god. You follow the god of the stones, god of the mountain. And the stone god, or the mountain god, or the sun god, or the earth god will be a witness against you. Not only will I condemn you, but all these others who've been witnesses to you will condemn you. Now, you follow what we're talking about? Let's ask some questions. Anybody got some questions about this trial, this covenant renewal ceremony? Because Psalm 50 is a psalm of covenant renewal after the controversy or trial of the people of God by God.
I'm not sure about that stone business, really. Now,
okay.
Did you say that it literally was a stone, a large stone?
Yes, this is a stone. We have what are called matzah bowls. in Shechem, where they've dug up, actually, where this scene takes place. They've dug up three standing stones that are about this high, about this thick. They almost look like early 20th century grave markers, when they even have the same shape, you know, like that. And these are stones which originally, now that's where I think I've confused you, originally many of these stones were evidences of a god, because the people were sort of animists or polytheists. And so everything had its own god, the Hittites and others. And the Canaanites did the same. They had many gods compared to one god the Hebrews had. Now he puts this up as a testimony, or maybe the better thing would be a memorial stone. Is that a better word? It's a memorial stone. What's a memorial stone? It's to remind me that my grandmother's dead and is over there. Not that I need it, but that was what it was for. And he puts a stone up to remind us that we had just made a covenant. Does that help?
Yeah.
It's a real stone in this instance.
These would be simply a bare stone. Would it be engraved?
In this instance, we think it was not engraved. Most of the stones in Shechem were not engraved. I've been there with the archaeological digs. And at Gezer, another town you may have heard, they found about 10 of these. And none of them were engraved. Now, there could be several reasons for that. One is that they weren't writing at that time in that particular group of people. They didn't have much writing, so they couldn't have engraved it. But the other is it didn't need to be. Once you've said that, this stone is forever a reminder to you. You don't have to put on it, please be reminded you made a covenant here. You know, it's already, just by its existence, is a reminder.
But then they would have, in fact, put some sort of a document in the temple.
Yes, yes, yeah. He says, that this translation says, these words in a book. Obviously, there weren't any books. Books didn't come in until post-New Testament times. There weren't any books in this form that you open pages up. What it really says, we wrote a tablet or we wrote a writing, and then we put it into the temple, right? Just like I put it in the safety deposit box. Any other questions about this thing? Then we're going to start with Psalm 50. Any other questions?
It's interesting to me that there's a very active Jewish community in Spokane, and that Micah verse is what appears in books that you provide at the synagogue, whether it's the cookbook or book on festivals or whatever, but that's the Micah verse is what you use.
And they recognize that that's a summary of the covenant.
Yeah.
The three aspects of the covenant. Obey the stipulations, respond to love with love, and remember who you are.
Right.
You are dust. Your frame is weak and mortal. And that's really what the Old Testament covenant is all about. Many synagogues have that phrase over the front portal as you enter. One in Toledo has that. Yeah, right over the front door. So as you walk in, you're reminded, like a stone would remind you, although there they got the thing. Any other additions?
That's why the Jewish people are so strong in their faith. Remember who you are.
Identity is significant. I not only remember who I am in the sense of Jewish, I remember who God is who called me. And we've got all kinds of memorial stones, memorial words like the Bible to remind us of that.
We're very aware of who they are in the congregation in Spokane. They're what they call the middle Jewish group.
Mm-hmm.
And the rabbi said that when they vote on the pastor, rabbi, priest, whatever, and the one thing that he said, they asked him, what would you never do? And he said, I would never, never perform a marriage between a Jew and a Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one thing that he says, we must keep ourselves.
Yeah, that's getting very strong. Since 1967, since the 67 war, Jewish identity is even stronger than it's ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Primarily because of that. Even the liberal Reform Jews, this is a conservative you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But the Reform Jews are even saying now we won't allow mixed marriages because you lose out of your family inheritance in eternity. Because there had been, for the early days of the late days of the 19th century and much of the early 20s, there was a lot of intermarriage and a lot of secularization of Judaism. But 1967 changed it for many Jews. Okay, let's turn to Psalm 50. Now, I give it a title. You may or may not like this title. Instead of calling it a Psalm of Asaph, and we don't know what a Psalm of Asaph means, there is a group of people in the temple hierarchy that are the family of Asaph, and that may be what's involved, and maybe they were the ones that had to do with hanging on to that testimony stone. or that seal that we were talking about. Maybe that was their job. We really don't know what it means. But my title for this is A Prophetic Liturgy of the Divine Trial. Dostoevsky, is it Dostoevsky, Dave, who has the grand assise, the big picture of the great heavenly trial? I think it's Dostoevsky. And this is what we're having here. This is the grand trial in a heavenly setting, or maybe it turns out to be in the mount of the temple. Let's look at the beginning of it. Verse 1 is, and verse 4 are pretty much the calling of the witnesses. Verse 2 and verse 3 are pretty much telling us about the setting around it. The mighty one, the God, the Lord. And those of you here yesterday, the word L-O-R-D with four letters means the covenant God, Yahweh. That's very clear. So you know it's a covenant possibility right away because that's the name they've used. They didn't say L-O-R-D with only the L capitalized, which would be my powerful one above me. This is a covenant one. He speaks, and look what he does. He calls the witnesses. He summons the earth from the rising of the sun to its setting, and all of it. And then verse 4, he calls to the heaven above the earth that he may judge his people. Now, there are going to be other things later on about this that we'll talk about, but there it is. Now, where is it taking place? This is a very interesting thing. Look at verse 2 and verse 3. Out of Zion, the perfection of beauty, God shines. And then our God comes. He does not keep silence. Before him is a devouring fire, and around him a mighty tempest. Now, maybe originally, if this were Hittite, fire and tempest would also be witnesses. But here they're doing two things. Can anybody tell me where there was a devouring fire and a tempest in the Bible that they're recalling? Mount Sinai. So they're putting together the Temple Mount, which is out of Zion. That Zion means the temple. Out of Zion, God is shining, his perfection shining forth in all his glory. And then, what's he doing? He's a devouring fire, just like the story in Exodus. The devouring fire, the volcanic eruption that took place at Mount Sinai, they're putting the two things together, the Mount of Covenant in Sinai and the Mount of the Temple, which was another covenant possibility, and they're putting it into heaven. In other words, they're using the two things. The judgment isn't taking place on Mount Sinai. The judgment isn't taking place in Jerusalem. But the judgment is taking place in that eternal mountain on which God sits, if you can accept that kind of poetry. I think that's poetry, isn't it, Karen? Okay, so here he is up on an eternal mountain, which isn't just a specific location. It's a conflation of the two famous mountains in Israel's history. Mount Zion in Jerusalem and Mount Sinai in Egypt. And you've got this great transfigured mountain on which the great God, the Mighty One, is there. And now, this time, instead of a bailiff calling it, well, it could be the bailiff, it could be the prophet, it could be somebody else. Gather my faithful ones who made a covenant with me, you know. You can't get away from that. You guys made it. You swore to it once. We even got a stone back there to look at to remind you if you've forgotten. You made a covenant with me by sacrifice. The heavens declare his righteousness, and God himself is judge. Selah. That's rather clear. Made a covenant with me by sacrifice. That's another kind of thing like the stone. When I sign something, I put my signature on it. Then maybe I get a notary public to put a seal on. And that makes it a legal document. Maybe I have some other witnesses besides the notary public to sign it, to make it legal. Hear what we're saying, and it's perfectly clear in many other traditions that we have in the Bible and other places in the Bible. When people make a covenant, they have a meal together. And the meal includes a sacrifice. The sacrifice of a lamb. Maybe if you and I are making an agreement, the priest or each of us mutually, we'd sprinkle either hyssop and with water on it, or we'd sprinkle blood from the heifer on each of us, and that binds us together. We've sworn, we've made a covenant together. When I was 13 years old, I was adopted into a Hopi tribe. Back in those days, that was one of the ways the Hopis not only got publicity, but they also got money and helped them to survive long before there was an American Indian movement. And the way they adopted me into the Hopi tribe back in, what would that be, 1924, something like that, 23, they prick our wrists, and the chief of the Hopi tribe, who happened to be there with about 10 other Hopis, male and female, would cut his wrist, and then we'd be adopted when we mix our blood. And just for fun of it, since I was called the, what was I called? The white-haired wolf or something. I really was called then, because my hair wasn't white, I was called Tall White Grass. That was my Indian name. Now, what we did, we sealed it, you see, with some kind of sacrificial act of blood. That's been done for generations, not just Indians, not just Jews, but people have done it way back. So you made a covenant with me. Remember, you swore. You maybe even shed lamb's blood, maybe even shed some of your own blood at the real covenant. Let's look at another passage in another psalm just to show you that this isn't all completely made up. Verse 14 in Psalm 25. Psalm 25, verse 14. Somebody want to read it for me?
The friendship of the Lord is for those who fear him, and he makes known to them his covenant.
He makes it known to them. That sort of makes them reminded of it. He reminds them of it and says, what you going to do about it now? To make known is to make you experience it. He not only gave it originally to them, he keeps reminding them of it. And that's what these covenant trials are all about. My suggestion and suspicion is, and some of the other scholars in Old Testament sort of agree with me, but we can't prove it. That's the trouble with a lot of things in the Bible. You can't prove it. You can only have a feeling that it's right. We think this covenant trial took place during Yom Kippur later on, when the people were supposed to acknowledge. You know, they only did it once a year. And immediately after Yom Kippur, originally, it's not that way exactly now, you have New Year's. And New Year's, you renew the covenant. When we were over in Persia for a while, we happened to hit Persian New Year's. Now, that happens to be Muslim, but it also has some primitive stuff that's pre-Muslim in it. But on New Year's, the day before New Year's, you take everything out of your house. You wash everything you own. All the rugs, all the clothes, all the floors, all the cupboards, whether you're rich or whether you just have a little one-room house, that's like Yom Kippur. You clean it all out. And then New Year's Day, you start clean and fresh with a whole new year ahead of you. Now, the head of the year, which is Rosh Hashanah, you know, that's the head of the year, the Jewish New Year. We think, most of us do, and I think you'll find it in most commentaries nowadays, that every year the king, if there was still a king, renewed on behalf of the people the covenant in the temple. And there was a ceremony. And psalms like Psalm 110 were there to remind us that we're going to clap. God is our God. He is our covenant Lord. And we accept it. I think this took place either on the eve of New Year's Day, or as part of what we could call now, it wasn't called that then, Yom Kippur, the covenant. And we think it took place once a year, just like it still does in Jewish and Muslim tradition. Okay? I can't prove the calendar on this. I can only suggest that it's possible. Now comes the specific charge. Is a very interesting one. Hear, O my people, and I will speak. O Israel, I will testify against you. I am God, your God. And then, he says, I don't reprove you for your sacrifices. Your burnt offerings are continually before me. See the opposite from what we saw in Micah? Here they probably already have said to him, God, you know, we've been going there every morning, every afternoon, every night, and you've got more bulls than you can handle. you know, they're probably saying, what a good boy I am. You know, he stuck in his thumb and pulled out a plum and said, what a good boy am I? Well, Jews and Christians do it all the time, too. They play that game with God, and that was a good matins this morning about that. I don't reprove you for that. You know, you're good at making sacrifices. You're very legalistic, and you keep that kind of stuff. And I think it's a horrible translation, but I guess with all the preachers in both synagogues and churches, you can translate it that way. I will accept no bull. I think what it really should be, I accept no bullocks. Maybe it'd be much better if we said bullocks instead of I accept no bull from you. But from your house, no he-goats from your fold. And then you see very similar to the Micah passage. It says, what do I need them for? You know, you're nice in sending them. You're nice in performing that part of it. But, you know, every beast of the forest is mine, the cattle on all the high hills. That can be translated as thousand hills or high hills. I know all the beasts of the air, or it can be translated, as you see in the footnotes, I know all the birds of the mountains. Up here at Holden, we might as well say all the birds of the mountains. And all that moves in the field is mine. If I were hungry, I would not tell you, for the world and all that is in it is mine. Now let's stop there for a minute. In other words, God's covenant is not earned by what you give to God. You know, I've got it all. You know, what you're doing is just returning to me what I've already got. That's why the New Testament concept of stewardship is in this psalm, if you want to put it there. You know, when I give to God, when I contribute to a congregation or a benevolent charity, or if I give time or talent or something, I'm not giving God anything. It's already His. Now, if you pick a picture of the Hittite king and some petty little chiefdoms and small little kingdoms down here, the king has let them rule by his grace. He could have put somebody else up. He could have sent a Hittite governor in, like the Romans did later with a guy named Pontius Pilate. Instead of having a Jewish king or a Jewish high priest ruling, he could have done that. But he's saying no. He says, I don't need all this. The land belongs to me. I conquered it, or I own it, however you want to put it in terms of your thing. Now it says, do I eat the flesh of bulls? Do I drink the blood of goats? Now comes the important part. This is what they haven't been doing, and it sort of ties you into Psalm 51, if you want to put it that way. Offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving. You haven't really been thankful. You've been legal. You've been keeping the statutes by making your sacrifices of lambs and pigeons and ewe goats and all the rest, and maybe even of cornmeal. I know they didn't have cornmeal, a barley cakes. But you haven't really been thankful about it. You haven't been gracious about my graciousness. You pick up Micah again. You haven't responded to my steadfast love with steadfast love. You've responded with laws. You've responded with sacrifices which are habitual. And I don't like that. Now he says, pay your vows to the Most High, and call upon me in the day of trouble, and I will deliver you, for you will glorify me. And then comes, within the same group of people, he says it even stronger. What right have you to recite my statutes? Take my covenant on your lips. You hate discipline, you cast my words, and the word words, by the way, is what the Ten Commandments are called. They're never called the Ten Commandments, and they're never counted as ten in the Bible. Whether it's the Exodus or the Deuteronomy, they're always called, God spoke these words, and they're the words of the Lord that came from Sinai, not the commandments of the Lord. We can call them commandments because that's the form they're in, but this is a specific thing to the Ten Commandments. There's no doubt about it. When you cast my words behind you, and then he has some more charges. If you see a thief, you're a friend of his, and you keep company with the adulterers. You give your mouth free rein with evil, and your tongue frames deceit. And you sit and speak against your brother, and you slander your mother's sons. Note, he's picked up some of the Ten Commandments right away, hasn't he? Those are really statements about the Ten Commandments. He hasn't hit them all, but he's hit a number of them. You know, the Eighth Commandment is very strong there. But now, these things you have done. The things you have done are the things you shouldn't have done. You follow what he says? It's sort of a reverse twist. these things you've done are the things you shouldn't have done, because you haven't done the things that I stipulated in my laws. You've done these things that I just listed. Your mouth did this, your tongue did that, you slander your mother's son, and so on. And I've been silent. You know, for a whole year, if you use my calendar idea, I haven't charged you with a blooming thing yet. I've kept loyal to you, I've protected you for this whole year, and there it is. But now, you made a mistake. You thought I was like you and was indifferent and didn't care and didn't love and didn't judge and didn't want to be the king, didn't want to be your ruler, didn't want to be your God. You know, we make a lot of assumptions about God. We make God in our own image, they say frequently. And I think that's the temptation of mankind, to make God in our own image. That's what he's saying. He said, go ahead, Karen.
I was going to say women don't do that.
Yeah. Women occasionally will do that. Let's give them some credit. Women will do that too sometimes. I don't want to charge them with too much. What we're saying here is very clearly, now I accuse you. Rebuke is too simple a word. In this kind of a psalm, in this kind of a context, I accuse. That's really what he's saying. It's a very strong word. And I lay this charge out before you. Simple? Okay, now what happens? We again get a suspended sentence like we did in Micah, or like we do at the end of Malachi. In fact, many people have made a false accusation against the Old Testament. They say the Old Testament ends in a curse and the New Testament ends in a blessing. Poppycock, it doesn't. They haven't read the Old Testament that carefully. It has the same word that we're now reading here. It says, lest I curse. Lest I curse. Does that mean I'm gonna? No, it says, it depends on you. You know, it doesn't say I am. You know, maybe he's just threatening us out of his love. Like I had to tell my kids, don't put your hand on that stove, it'll burn. If you put your hand on that stove, not only will it get burnt on the hand, you'll get burnt on the fanny. The stove will do one and daddy will do the other. And that's what Malachi ends with. And we have that here too. Listen to what he has. This is Yom Kippur, if you want to put it. It's the Day of Atonement just before the New Year. Mark this then, you who forget God. Forget is the opposite of remember, right? And what is remember, those of you here yesterday? Remember is not just intellectual, it's acting on it. Remembering the covenant means you live up to the covenant, you act on the covenant. Forgetting the covenant doesn't mean you forgot how to say the Ten Commandments or you couldn't say the third line of the 23rd Psalm this morning. Isn't what we're talking about. It's that you don't do what you're supposed to do.
It's the same as the phrase at Eucharist, do this in remembrance. It means not just memory, but
definitely.
In celebration.
Dave's been around here and listened to me before, and I gave a series of talks about the Old Testament and the New Testament in relationship to the Eastern Orthodox Church. And remembering and intellectualizing is part of our Western tradition. But experiencing and feeling and doing it is part of the Eastern tradition. And we sometimes think you got to have the right doctrine to get to the altar. Or we got to remember exactly how Jesus did it and have the right theory of what redemption or the right theology of atonement is the phrase that a lot of people use. Whereas if you remember he loved you and you respond with some deeds like James and Jude and others say, that love is mine. That's the remembering that we have. Okay? Now look, there's the word, lest I rend. And brother, if God rends you, who's there to deliver you? There's none to deliver. It's the same thing as when the Hittite king or the Assyrian king would say to a little vassal, if you don't behave, I'll run you out of this country and maybe lay waste to your whole land. Remember at the last days of Judah, the Assyrians put some little puppets in some of them were Jews and some of them were non-Jews. And when the Jew didn't obey very long, the Assyrian just kicked him out. Some of them lasted less than a year. Lest I come and then who's going to deliver you? And of course, Jeremiah got stuck in that fight, if you remember a little of your history.
Our translation says or.
Or, okay.
Just as strong.
Sure it is. If it could be. If you don't, this is the way it's going to happen. Or I'll render and there'll be none to deliver.
Destroy you.
They use the word stronger, destroy. Okay. Very good. Now, here comes practically the same thing as the promise. If you live up to it, he who brings thanksgiving as a sacrifice, and you remember that was over there in verse 14 already. He's now giving you what you got to do to keep this covenant going. Bring thanksgiving. Who orders his way aright, that's the first part of the Micah 6:8 passage. You live according to the covenant. You keep the stipulations. The word righteous, to be righteous or to be just in the Old Testament, always meant living up to the stipulations in the covenant. It doesn't have what we think of the word justice. So if we talk about justice today, that's a whole other concept. The Old Testament didn't have that broad idea of what we call justice. Justice and righteousness were specifically defined by the covenant. Exodus and Deuteronomy mainly. And that's what he's saying here. Orders your way aright. Then I will show the salvation of God. And note that's still in a quotation marks. To show the salvation of God means you'll now be able to enter up on that holy mountain. You'll now be able to enter into the messianic banquet, if you want to move it into New Testament concepts. You'll now be able to celebrate the victory with me, and you won't be defeated, and you'll be protected from all your enemies, just like we said in Psalm 23. I fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff are with me. Whether it's death or demons or people from another country. So that's the promise. Now, normally in other places, just as we had in Joshua, you might get some vows added and another set of witnesses that are added to the end after we get the judgment or the assembled judgment. Let's see whether you have some questions, and then I'll show you a couple other places where you might find this again and look at it.
Because the format is so much alike in this Psalm and Joshua and Micah, could it be that this is history repeating itself, or is it that the writers, like David, were so steeped in the law and history that they might have all been writing about the same thing? Or was it happening again over there in the different periods?
Can I answer the question by saying both?
Okay. It's a real question.
No, it's a good question. What I would say is, yes, every year, if you take my calendar idea, it happens every year in everybody's life and in Israel's existence. But at specific times, there were crises and David's time, there were crises in Isaiah's time, there were crises in Jeremiah's time and Amos's time, there were crises after the prophets were all gone. So I would say yes to that part of your question. Now, I heard behind it the other question, did they write this style kind of thing? I'm going to use you, Karen, because we were talking ahead of time. Some poetry has a specific kind of style, a sonnet, or it has a certain kind of beat, or an elegy has a certain mood about it and that sort of thing, and so you write this. The Hittites and the Assyrians had a style that was a historical, legal, covenant treaty, okay? It is then used in the Bible by many different people from the 15th century on down to almost the time of Jesus. The Dead Sea Scrolls people have one that uses some of these allusions, and they're just about the time of Jesus. So they used this literary form, which was a historical, political covenant, in a theological context, so that they didn't have to reinvent the wheel, let's put it that way, each time. In other words, when Joshua said it, he had some forms. When Amos and Micah said it, they had the same forms. When Isaiah and somebody else said it, they had the form. So the form was there, just like many people in English literature have written sonnets. They didn't have to invent the form of the sonnet over again. Or maybe it's easier for us to say we don't have to invent the form of a limerick over again. A limerick is a limerick. And everybody knows the form, or almost everybody knows. So the answer is yes to both of your questions. Some others? Yeah.
Last Saturday was Rosh Hashanah, and this coming Monday is Yom Kippur.
Right.
And I was wondering what our Jewish friends do with this matter of atonement. How do they work that through? What do they do? I talked to the cantor from the synagogue last weekend. We're friends. And he says it was just a tremendous day of rejoicing. He's been a cantor for over 50 years. And great high celebration, great music, great everything. And they were looking forward to Yom Kippur, but he didn't say a lot about how they worked that.
Yom Kippur, and that's why I said what you just said. I said probably it went the other way originally.
Yeah, that's interesting to me because now it's
it comes afterwards now, and but what they're doing now is, you see, it's the temple's no longer, and so they're cleansing themselves for the rest of the year.
Now they just reminding themselves of the covenant, like in my case, that day they just remember the covenant.
The new year is remembering the covenant. The Yom Kippur is the annual confessional service. They lament, they use psalms of lamentation, they use psalms of confession of sin and rebellion. They also use psalms that suggest God's maybe going to throw them out because they really don't deserve his love. They understand, you know, we, because of our Old Testament, New Testament equation with law and gospel, which it isn't, I mean, that isn't the equation. They know that God loves them, and that's gospel. They might not want to use the word, but that's what they're rejoicing in at the new year. But they're confessing the fact that we haven't responded loyally, just like Micah says in this psalm. So Yom Kippur, or Yom Kippur, has some of the most tragic, wailing music connected with it. I happen to like it, but if you go to a Yom Kippur, the one that's most famous is called Kol Nidre. It's a tune of one of the chants. And it's the voice, Kol means voice. It's the voice of sorrow and lamentation. It's almost like Rachel crying over her children kind of thing. And you get that sadness out of it. And so that's the purpose of it. Yom Kippur is their lowest day of the year, if you want to put it that way.
But is it indeed the one day out of the entire year where they deal totally with confession?
Yes, it's the only day they deal
with
confession. Yeah, there is no other day for confession. You go to the synagogue, except for...
It doesn't show up in the services on Friday.
No, right. If you go to a Friday or a Saturday service, they may use a psalm that has some confession elements in it, but they didn't use it because it was confession that they were about to do. They used it because it was part of the scripture. Just like when we read the psalm before the gospel lesson, the psalm might have confession in it, but we've had confession earlier or on another day. The psalm isn't being read to say, now confess. And that's true of the Sabbath, Friday, or Saturday services.
Yeah, women are not permitted in the synagogue in Spokane on Saturday. You can go Friday, but women are not
in the conservative. Yeah, conservatives sometimes do have that. All Orthodox, of course, rule that very short. Some other questions on this? Yeah.
The last verse brought out the thought that I found in studying the Psalms that was highly impressed is that praise and thanksgiving is God's top priority, and that this is the thing that both we and the Jews have a tendency to avoid. We stress works and ritual ahead of praise and thanksgiving. I found as I read other verses, Psalms, that they're chapter after chapter after chapter.
There are plenty.
That is loaded praise and thanks to the Lord for this and that. Seems like we've seen a mess on that.
Psalm 51, which is the next psalm, of course, verses 15 and 16 are so clear on that, and even 17. O Lord, open thou my lips, and my mouth shall show forth thy praise. For thou hast no delight in sacrifice. Were I to give a burnt offering, thou wouldst not be pleased. the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit, a broken and a contrite heart, O God, thou wilt not despise. And that just reaffirms what you're saying. Anything else that anyone wants to look at? I'd like to turn to another passage just so you get the idea of how these trials are used, if you don't have any question on the psalm. Do you get the general form of what we're talking about? Whether you move it into polytheism of the Assyrians and the Hittites, or whether you move it into the monotheism of the Israelites, it's the same form. In other words, here, with the invitation and the settings, you've just taken the Godhead away from all the gods. And you just made them into ordinary, you know, mountains. And seas and trees and stuff. And, you know, clap your hands, O ye hills. You know, that's a metaphor, isn't it? Or is it, you know, it's a metaphor. Forgotten. Which is a metaphor, which is a simile. Simile is used like an ass, right? Okay. Pick up on my literature from way, way back. Okay, let's turn to the first chapter of Isaiah. I like the first chapter of Isaiah for two reasons. Some of you heard my first reason, but I'm now going to give you the second reason. Isaiah chapter 1. Now, the first reason, if you weren't here, why I like Isaiah 1 is it's the best definition of sin in the entire Bible. Chapter 1, verse 3. Or 2 or 3, if you want to. The last half of 2. But note how it begins in verse 2. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. This may, as I said, sometimes the prophets may be the prosecuting attorney. There is one theory, I don't happen to hold it, that prophets worked at the sanctuaries and at the temple, and that their major job was to remind people that you're breaking the covenant even though you're sacrificing. But that was their major task. I like it, but I don't think it's necessarily true. I think a lot of them came there, just like Jesus came there and let the people have it. But that they were an official prosecuting attorney on the trial at Yom Kippur or whatever, I don't know. But look at it. Then what's the charge? The Lord has spoken, and here's the charge. See how far the quote goes? How far does it go? Well, I guess we better say it stops approximately through verse 9. Or maybe through verse 8 would be better. Anyhow, it tells you, sons have I reared and brought up, and they have rebelled against me. That's sin. That's alienation and rebellion. It's the same word, by the way, that's translated transgression in most of the King James. I have transgressed. And it's properly translated here, rebelled. The ox knows its master, the owner, the ass its master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not understand. And then he goes on, they forsake him, they despise, they're utterly estranged. That sort of gives you another definition, doesn't it? Of alienation of affection. That's what sin is. Sin is alienation and rebellion. Why do you continue to rebel? What's wrong with you? You know, you're not just rebelling in your soul, by the way, you note. You're sick all over. You're rebelling from the sole of your foot to your head. Your country, and then, you know, how come you're so dumb? Your country's a mess. Can't you recognize that you're in a mess because you haven't been obeying, you haven't been loving, you haven't been living up to the covenant? Why are you in such trouble? You ought to need this trial. You ought to know. Your country lies desolate, your cities are burned with fire, and so on. And the daughters of Zion left like a booth in a vineyard, like a lodge in a cucumber field, like a besieged city. And then his gentleness. The Lord of hosts had not left us a few survivors, we would have been like Sodom and become like Gomorrah. And then comes more of that irony we had in the other psalm, remember? Hear the word of the Lord, you rulers of Sodom. You know, these guys thought they were ruling Jerusalem, but they aren't. And then look at this, verse 11. Multitude of sacrifices. You've heard that twice already today, haven't you? I don't need all that. I have enough burnt offerings. I don't delight probably between verse 9 and 10, you had the defense. And he's now saying, okay, I heard it. You celebrate the new moon. You bring all the morning and evening and afternoon and midnight sacrifices. You tithe, your mint and your anise and your cumin. I've heard all that. So what? And then he comes down with telling them, that's not enough. You really missed the whole thing. Look at the word, verse 12. When you come to appear before me, who requires of you this trampling of my courts? That word require is the same word that's in Micah 6:8. What does the Lord require of you? And here it's used in a negative sense. I don't require that kind of junk. I don't require this kind of jumping around and prancing. I cannot endure your iniquity, the solemn assemblies, your new moons, appointed feasts, when you spread your hands and so on. Then verse 16 and 17. Look at 17. It gets awfully close to Micah. It has a little bit more detail in it. Cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, defend the fatherless, plead for the widows. And then comes the final part of it that LBJ used all the time. That was his favorite quotation when he got in trouble. Come now, let us reason together. Though your sins be like scarlet, so on, I'm going to give you. But look at verse 20 again. And I think verse 20 is the end of the trial. He's ending the same way the psalm ends. It's sort of less, or if, or your or. If you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Those 1 to 20 is a trial form. Whether it was actually used in a trial, I don't know. Are you beginning to get the idea? Feel comfortable with the way those quotation marks are used? Most of the time in the RSV, the quotation marks are okay. There are occasional times when two speakers get conflated and they're put together and the quotation marks don't separate properly. But it's a good one. Okay?